Hello and welcome to Season 2 of Death and Taxes, a weekly podcast by the private client team at Burgess Salmon. My name is Guy Broadfield and I am a tax and trust lawyer in the private client team. In this special episode of Death and Taxes, we have partnered with the Institute for Family Business to discuss succession planning for family businesses. In part one of this two-part mini-series, Richard Handel and I discuss the impact of divorce on family businesses. In this second part, I'm joined by Caroline Emsley, a senior associate in the firm's disputes team, to discuss the impact disputes can have on a family business. Caroline advises on a broad range of contentious matters, with an emphasis on disputes relating to trusts, wills, and tax planning, in particular in family businesses. The Institute for Family Business, known as the IFB, is a dedicated and independent membership organisation whose aim is to champion and support family businesses. It is the largest family business organisation in the UK and has a wide range of family businesses as members across the country. We discuss the IFB in more detail in part one of this mini-series. So to find out more about the IFB, please listen to that episode or see the IFB website, ifb.org.uk. So, Caroline, what we've spoken about with Richard is the impact of quite a specific event on a family, of course, on the individual in question and then and the wider family members. And, you know, some business families may be impacted by divorce, some may not. Of course, many hope that they won't, but it sometimes does happen. But I think when it comes to the points that I've discussed with you, it's important to note that, you know, some families, business families, may not be impacted by divorce, but that doesn't mean there is not a risk of dispute as between the family members that might impact the business at some point. And indeed, some of the characteristics of family businesses do lend themselves to the possibility of at least minor disagreement in some cases and more fundamental dispute as well. So is it worth just explaining your thoughts on that in the first instance?
Sure. Yeah, I agree. I think in order to give a family business the best chance of being passed on, it's really fundamentally important to try to insulate that business against disputes. And that's whether during the lifetime of the business or on the transfer of power. Family businesses are liable to face the same issues and the same disputes as other trading businesses, you know, supply and contract disputes, employment disputes, all of those types of issues. But the family relationships which underpin family businesses mean that they can be open to family business specific risks and potential disputes, as you mentioned. Disputes between family members can happen anytime, but the importance for succession is that they have the potential to really disrupt the proper running of the business. They can cause financial uncertainty and then impact on business management. And if there's uncertainty, it's going to be much more difficult for businesses to take opportunities as they arise, to invest in growth, and also to facilitate the business being passed on in the way that the owners might have hoped or anticipated. And I think on that point, the fundamental points that I would kind of flag for family businesses and business owners to focus on are making sure that the rights and obligations of the business owners and the other family members are clearly understood and clearly documented, and also making sure that they've planned in advance for contingencies, including a loss of capacity or death. And particularly in relation to the transfer of control, it's really important to just make sure that as far as possible, whilst those conversations can be quite difficult, to make sure that all of the family members appreciate what the plan is. And I think it's normal for family members involved in a family business to have their own expectations and hopes for what will happen next and what their part in that will be, and to try to make sure that there are no surprises as things kind of play out, because that's certainly a fertile breeding ground for disputes.
Yeah, because there are elements to which, you know, discussions happen between family members, either around the dinner table or otherwise, and sometimes they're talking to each other as siblings, or, you know, as parents and children, without really thinking of themselves as shareholders in a business.
And yeah, that, absolutely.
That can lead to certain expectations on one side or the other, which do need to be managed to avoid the risk of any future disagreement, yes, to the extent one party is doesn't necessarily get what they expect,
yep,
or not treated in the way that they would hope.
And I think that leads into an interesting issue which arises in the context of family businesses run via limited companies, and a point around unfair prejudice petitions where people had expectations as to how the business was going to be run that perhaps arose, or they feel that they have an entitlement which perhaps aren't, you know, it's not their clearly documented rights as a shareholder, but it's something that is a right which has arisen as a result of agreements or understandings between them and their family members, which are perhaps not clearly documented.
And so this is typically when we talk about unfair prejudice, this is about saying, okay, we've got a family business, the family shareholders are, say you've got, you know, five family shareholders, you may have one family shareholder who's a minority shareholder on their own, they may own 20% of the company,
mm-hmm,
and by virtue of the running of that company, either by the other four shareholders or the directors, that minority shareholder feels that they have been unfairly prejudiced.
Exactly.
And there's a claim that they can bring that allows them to, if it's, what happens if that unfair prejudice is established? What does that mean?
Well, I think, so unfair prejudice petitions can be brought by any shareholder of a company or group of shareholders. And to succeed, those shareholders need to plead and prove a complaint that the affairs of the company have been conducted in a way, as you said, that harms their interest as a shareholder. And the normal outcome, if somebody is successful in an unfair prejudice petition, and I am saying this is the norm, not what the court is bound to do, there's quite a lot of options for the courts, but the norm is that the majority shareholders will be required to purchase the shares of the minority shareholder, and often at full value, so without a minority shareholder discount. And that can lead, again, to further issues and questions around the valuation of those shares. As we mentioned earlier, there are often multiple ways to value shares, and that can be kind of a broader dispute which involves looking really carefully at the business. And so this is, I think, the kind of takeaway from this is it's kind of helpful example of how taking steps to make sure that things are really documented and included within, you know, if you want to give all of the siblings, for example, if you want to give all of the siblings a right to participate in the management of the company, then the best way to do that is to make sure that that right is documented in a shareholder agreement. And if you want to exclude a right to participate in management, again, you can do that in a shareholders agreement, and you can agree that the individuals have documented all of the rights and obligations that are owed to them, and there's nothing else which is perhaps an equitable right which has been agreed separately or which isn't documented and is less formal. I think, yeah, it's just a good example of why documenting things and making sure that things aren't done informally, which, you know, it isn't always the case in family businesses, but it's just sometimes it can be more likely that there will be informal agreements or understandings which sit behind things just because of the nature of the family relationships underpinning the business.
Yeah. And ultimately, you know, any sort of unfair prejudice petition would be destabilizing for the business.
Absolutely.
It would cause a liquidity issue for the majority shareholders if they're required to buy out the minority shareholder.
Yeah.
It would drive a coach and horses through any succession plans that there are. So to avoid that, the takeaway points are, make sure your plans for succession are communicated clearly to all family members and then documented correctly. And that, as between, you know, the family members, they should, as far as they can, look to act in accordance with their rights and obligations in the documents.
Yep, I think that's right.
So largely what we've spoken about so far has been on disputes during the lifetime of family members. But I suppose quickly we need to cover off the important topic, which we could probably cover in a completely separate episode, about the types of disputes that can arise on the death of a family member, particularly with regards to wills and perhaps unexpected provision in wills for some family members.
Yes. I think it's often seen as a key feature of wills in England and Wales that testators can, broadly speaking, do what they want with their assets, but that absolute testamentary freedom is hemmed in by other rules, and there are claims that can impact on it. So, for example, claims for reasonable financial provision under the Inheritance Act by individuals who don't consider that reasonable financial provision has been made for them under somebody's will, or perhaps estoppel or constructive trust claims, whereby somebody feels that a promise or assurance has been made to them regarding what they're going to receive. They then rely on that assurance and they suffer detriment as a result of that assurance not having been honoured. And I think it's those types of issues. It's hard to undersell the trouble which can be caused by a claim which attacks a will and changes the distribution of an estate.
Linked to that is, to the extent that family members are surprised about the provisions in a will, or it may not give effect to what they hoped, is the question of possible challenge to the terms of that will and indeed the capacity of the person who wrote it. And there are, yes, there are various ways to challenge a will that we see.
There are. And I think capacity issues and challenges to the validity of wills are frequent. And in order to try to address or cover off those types of claims, it's really important that, you know, wills are thought of upfront and well in advance. So not left to the 11th hour where people are kind of rushing around trying to make a will because somebody is concerned about their health. It's those situations in particular where capacity issues can also arise. It's thinking about it well in advance so there's enough time to really think about how the business is going to be dealt with and passed on and to make sure that the will joins up with that. And that if there are any potential capacity issues, there's time to take medical advice and get reports which confirm the capacity of the individual making the will. And, you know, it's, again, it's about addressing those issues up front. And you mentioned surprises. I think in terms of all of those potential claims against estates or against the validity of wills, it's about addressing things up front, so the will itself and any potential capacity issues and also the expectations of family members. And those conversations can be really, really difficult to have, but are so important because whilst they might be difficult for the person considering how to structure their affairs, they can be even more difficult and potentially really damaging for the family as a whole if, following the death of that patriarch or matriarch or family member, then there is a subsequent family dispute, which, you know, that can result in a really long-term conflict between family members. So if there's anything that can be done to try to address that in advance and make sure that people's expectations are managed, then that can be really, really valuable.
And certainly when it comes to the older generation, you know, those family members may consider using trusts as part of their succession planning, whereby, for example, they may decide to transfer their shares in the family business to a family trust, either one created during their lifetime or one that's created on their death under the terms of their will, whereby nominated trustees hold the shares for the benefit of the family members in question. Now, that's clearly a very different dynamic to the situation where the different family members hold their shares individually. And, you know, typically you might find that in that scenario, the trustees of the family trust hold all of the shares in a family business for the benefit of the family members. And there are any reasons, tax and otherwise, for following that route. In one case, it might reduce the possibility of an argument as between family members, at least at shareholder level, because there is, or it can be, a single shareholder holding all the shares, and that allows for a sort of continuity of a single shareholder voice, which might make matters easier for the directors and allow them to carry on with the business on a commercial level. But of course, it's not always a given that the family members and perhaps the younger generation agree with the trust type structure, whereby it is the trustees and not the beneficiaries who are making decisions in their capacity as shareholders of the business. And that can lead to dissatisfaction or disagreement if the beneficiaries, the family members in question, don't agree with the decisions the trustees are taking. Now, of course, I mean, when it comes to family trusts and family businesses, it is very fact specific. So, you know, it depends on the terms of the trust, it depends who the beneficiaries are. But most importantly, it depends who the trustees are. And it's important for anyone who's considering going down that route to think about their choice of trustees, because that's crucial. And importantly, how they will engage with the family members / the beneficiaries going forward. Whether family members are trustees or not is a matter for discussion. But the engagement between trustees and the family is critical to ensure that the family members don't feel detached from the business and feel like they still have an interest in the business over the long term. So broadly, Caroline, whether or not a family decides to use a trust to hold family shares, or individual members are going to hold those shares going forward, in either case, the importance of succession planning can't be underestimated. In the first instance, it's crucial to have a plan that is communicated to all of the family members so that everyone knows where they stand. And that plan has to consider or take account of possible future risks like divorce, on the basis that everyone hopes that that doesn't happen, but has to realise that that is a possibility. And tied in with that plan, you can take steps to try and protect the business against those risks. So prenups and postnups, such as the ones Richard mentioned. But then also, once that plan has been agreed, it does need to adapt and be able to change in the circumstances. And so it's something that has to be continuously monitored and implemented. And that does require quite a lot of input from the family members.
Yes, one of the big issues which often leads to disputes is surprises. And as you were saying, as a family business grows or changes over time, expectations are likely to change and discussions will be had as to how things might be passed on. And if documents and plans aren't more formally updated, then it can lead to a risk that on the transfer of power, people are surprised as to what ends up happening, because actually their expectations from discussions with family members aren't reflected in the documents that haven't been updated for some years. The documents perhaps aren't really fit for purpose based on what the family business looks like now. And it's just keeping on top of that to make sure that there's no nasty surprises for anyone.
And particularly also if over the course of that time, the family business has been successful and has grown in value, you know, the plan that was agreed or at least talked about 15 years ago may not reflect what is needed right now.
Absolutely. And then
there's more value to argue about, which can lead to a greater chance of dispute. So something that has to be kept under close review. And that's whether you're an individual family member or a trustee of a family trust who holds shares in a family business. Thanks again for listening to Death and Taxes, a private client podcast from Burgess Salmon. You can find out more about Burgess Salmon and our team at burgess-salmon.com or on our LinkedIn page. On next week's episode, we will be discussing philanthropy and how individuals can look to benefit the causes close to them. So don't forget to subscribe to listen to all episodes from season 1 and 2.